Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is John Pfeffer. John Pfeffer is the author of Splinterlands. He's the director of Foreign Policy in Focus and the author of several books and numerous articles, as well as a half dozen one-man shows. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
So I would like to start with a quote from you, which is, empires, like adolescents, think they'll live forever. In geopolitics, as in biology, expiration dates are never visible. When death comes, it's always a shock. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, it was my observation that, you know, when you're in the thick of it, when you're in the thick of an empire, you don't really expect that it will ever end, that it becomes the status quo, and the status quo seems to be elevated to the level of an eternal principle. If you're in the middle of the Roman Empire, well, the Roman Empire becomes this kind of unchangeable, ever-developing, ever-enlarging phenomenon, and you can't imagine that it will ever end, because, of course, your whole livelihood is connected to this empire. If you're an emperor or you're the lowliest member of the empire, you're connected in this kind of imperial fabric that seems never ending. But of course, in retrospect, you look back and not only do you see that these empires end, but you see the cracks, you see the inevitability of these empires collapsing. And, you know, you also see that they behave in the same kind of reckless manner that adolescents do, without regard to the future, without regard to their own safety. And they do so because, in some sense, they are under the impression that they will live forever. And because they'll live forever, they'll have 9 lives. They can make these mistakes. Nothing is irreparable. But, of course, again, in retrospect, all of this becomes clear, as it becomes clear for adults looking back not only at their own adolescence and the crazy stuff they did back then, but, you know, when they look at their children or at other adolescents and they perceive that this kind of mindset is so embedded, and it's very difficult from the outside to persuade either adolescents or empires that their recklessness is dangerous and that they do have an expiration date.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the commonalities, some of the markers of the end of empire, some of the things that happen at the end of empires historically, and then eventually we'll apply them to the current situation.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the marks for early empires is resource depletion. And I know that might sound strange because, of course, you know, if you go back to the Mayan period or the Mycenaean period, you think, well, those were periods of time marked by unlimited resources. This was before, you know, manufacturing, before we polluted the planet, before we even discovered oil and natural gas and fossil fuels. These are times of almost Arcadian bliss. And yet, even these empires encountered resource constraints. In the case of the Mayans, they ultimately kind of farmed their land so extensively as to rob the land of the necessary nutrients to keep the farming sustainable. And with a growing population, it simply became impossible to sustain this empire. With the Romans, of course, the empire became unsustainable for a number of different reasons. Resources, they too had, it seemed, unlimited access to resources that they were bringing in from Northern Africa, from the Middle East, even from as far away as England. But the problem for the Romans seemed to be another matter altogether. And that was, you could argue, imperial overstretch. In other words, that the empire became so large and extended over such a vast territorial expanse that administratively it became impossible to maintain any kind of coherence, because of course there was going to be division, political division, there was going to be ethnic division between the different groups within the empire, and Rome from the center simply could not maintain either administrative control or military control over such a vast territory. And then you could argue as well that that Rome was not sustainable economically because of the vast wealth that came to Rome and that was concentrated in the hands of the relative few. This, of course, was not a middle-class society. It was a society of great wealth, a few people in the middle ranks, and then a vast array of slaves and agricultural peons. And that too became unsustainable. It became impossible for Rome to maintain control over such a huge number of people who were getting so little out of the empire. So, imperial overstretch, kind of the natural resources constraints, those become two very important issues. If you come into the more modern period and you look at, say, the collapse of the Soviet Union, you could add a couple of other factors. One would be a kind of sclerosis. The political center in Moscow was simply robbed of any kind of innovation, certainly in the political sphere, but even to a certain extent in the economic sphere, despite some reforms that took place in the 1960s. But there was no opportunity for kind of new ideas and new blood to come into Moscow until the very end, right at the kind of end of the Soviet period. And it was too late when Gorbachev kind of finally rose through the ranks to take control. But at that point, the economy was practically moribund, and there were considerable tensions between the periphery and the center in the Soviet Union. And so the kind of political and the economic sclerosis in the Soviet Union, I think, doomed that project. There simply was not a capacity to innovate at a time. I mean, it may have, if the Soviet Union had existed, if you could imagine it existing in the Middle Ages, sclerosis may not have been such a problem, since plenty of institutions were sclerotic in the 13th century. But by the time you get to the 20th century, and, you know, impact of fast-moving developments in technology, in the economy, in geopolitics, Soviet Union was simply not nimble enough an institution to adapt to those trends.
So, with the possible exception of the sclerosis, aren't a lot of those problems inherent by definition in empires, since empires are based on, I mean, by definition, an empire. Well, I'll back up. So, can you define empire for me, please?
Sure. So, it is difficult, relatively, to define empire because you have very different examples of it. And but generally, you have a kind of hub and spoke relationship between the center and the periphery. The center, the administrative center, the economic center, the political center, basically controls the periphery, and the periphery is composed of some element of diversity. In other words, it's territorial diversity, ethnic diversity, religious diversity, economic diversity. There has been some takeover, shall we say, of that periphery by the center in a kind of accretion process, whereby what started out as a relatively small, perhaps a nation state or a relatively small territorial unit, gets larger by absorbing greater swaths of territory, even while it maintains kind hegemonic control over that territory. And that hegemonic control can be expressed in different ways, but for the most part, the decision-making takes place in the center, the decision-making on the key issues, the larger economic planning, foreign policy questions, military policy questions. It also might extend to cultural matters, such as the imposition of a religion, for instance, or the imposition of linguistic conformity. So that, in some sense, is an empire. But if you look at, for instance, the development of France as a nation state, you know, some of that development seems very imperial in its growth. That, in other words, I'm not talking about Algeria or more far-flung colonial possessions of France. I'm talking about the development of France as a nation state in the 18th century after the French Revolution, where the center in Paris establishes that kind of hegemonic control over a very diverse territory, including Provence and Bretagne and other aspects of other kind of ethnically distinct, linguistically distinct parts of the country. And yet, we tend not to consider France an empire, at least within its territorial confines, because we have defined the nation state a certain way after the 17th, 18th century, such that territorial contiguity and a kind of historical tradition, if you will, separates this kind of nation state that has hegemonic control from the center from a more far-flung empire with its hub and spoke arrangement.
So the United States would not be considered an empire because it extracts resources from West Virginia, but it would be considered an empire for extracting resources from the Philippines.
Mm.
Is that kind of what you're saying?
Exactly. Although even the relationship between the United States and its more far-flung partners, shall we say, is not strictly speaking an empire. I mean, generally people talk about it as a hegemonic relationship. In other words, for instance, the Philippines, even though we might be extracting raw materials from the Philippines, it has its own separate government, it has its own separate military and foreign policy and economic decision-making. Now, the reason why it's hegemonic, of course, is that hegemony is when the other country thinks it's independent, thinks it's functioning in an independent way, but in some sense is still operating within the confines of the imperial center or the hegemonic center. In other words, yes, of course, Philippines has its own separate government, but particularly at you know, peak moments of the relationship between the United States and the Philippines is basically doing what the United States wants it to do, even though it has formal independence. But, you know, if we use the term empire more loosely, we can see that the United States does have this hub-and-spoke relationship with its more far-flung allies around the world.
So I want to quote something else that you said that really fascinated me, which is just before all hell broke loose in 1914, of course you're referring to World War One. The world witnessed an unprecedented explosion of global trade at levels that would not be seen again until the 1980s. Just before the Nazis took over in 1932, Germans in the Weimar Republic were enjoying an extraordinary blossoming of cultural and political liberalism. Just before the Soviet Union imploded in 1991, Soviet scholars were pointing proudly to rising rates of intermarriage among the many nationalities of the Federation as a sign of ever greater social cohesion. So that paragraph strikes me as just extraordinarily fascinating. And what does it mean?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I put it in there because I wanted to suggest, with the United States at least, that we were seeing a kind of an embrace of economic globalization, an embrace of liberal values, an embrace of internationalism in, you know, represented by the United Nations or by, say, the Paris Accord on climate change, that, in other words, the United States seemed to be, in our period, you know, coming to the end of the Obama administration, its two terms, it seemed to be on this kind of inevitable movement forward in a broadly progressive, when I say progressive, I mean progressive in almost in the 19th century term, understanding of the term, not progressive in, say, the American 1990s sense of the word. And that's why I include economic globalization in that, that this is a kind of a movement toward, if you will, almost toward world government, toward a world economy, toward a kind of all-pervasive liberal culture of tolerance and multiculturalism, etc. And, you know, I wrote this before the election of Donald Trump, the book Splinterlands, but I was very concerned about what I saw as a strong backlash to all three of those trends, the economic, the cultural, and the political as well. A backlash against liberalism and liberal internationalism more generally. And this backlash, you could identify it kind of emerging perhaps first in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, and a backlash against what many perceived as the failures of liberalism coming out of the 1989 revolutions. But spreading as well to Western Europe, and a backlash against the European Union and what the European Union represents in terms of economic globalization and cultural tolerance, and as well as kind of a spirit of regionalism or slash internationalism. So the development of a very strong Eurosceptic movements in France, in the UK, Netherlands, in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect there to be a backlash, because these are countries that either are doing quite well economically, in the case of the Netherlands, or countries that have, you know, been so inextricably connected to European integration, like France, that it was almost inconceivable to imagine that people wouldn't see their future as being with Europe more generally. But I was seeing that in the United States as well. In other words, you know, there were a tremendous number of people in the United States who felt that they were not benefiting from economic globalization, that they were losing jobs, that they were watching the collapse of manufacturing in this country, that they were losing out to robotics. That there are any number of reasons why technology slash globalization were not benefiting them, but they were not happy and they wanted to change. But we also saw a kind of pushback against what was considered to be uber-liberalism, you know, too much emphasis on identity politics or multiculturalism or what was considered quote-unquote politically correct. And finally, a backlash against all the political authorities connected to these developments. In other words, members of both political parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans, who had effectively endorsed these economic transformations, pre-trade deals, for instance, as well as bilateral trade deals, and participation in international financial institutions, which many people, again, in this backlash community, were not perceiving as beneficial to the United States. So these three backlashes coming together, and it occurred to me that we were at the same moment now in 2016, when I was finishing the book, that we were in terms of the world, in 1914, in 1932, and for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in 1988, 1989. In other words, a moment of cleavage, a moment in which that which seems inevitable, that which seems, you know, inexorable forward movement was going to be, was going to hit up hard against a wall and not only be stopped, but actually rolled back, just as it was rolled back by World War I, just as it was rolled back by the Nazis, just in some senses it was rolled back by the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. And So that's why I wrote that. You know, I wanted to suggest that, and again, the book Splinterlands was not really meant to anticipate the election of Donald Trump in 2016 or the Brexit vote. I expected that the UK would reject the Brexit referendum, and I expected American voters to reject Donald Trump based on all the public opinion polls. My book was meant as a warning against complacency. I was saying, look, you think that we've dodged the bullet, and this is not 1914, this is not 1932. But I'm saying that if Trump loses in 2016, his supporters are not going away. They're not moving to New Zealand. They're still going to be here, and they're still going to represent a significant political force, and they will have a better candidate, in other words, a more sophisticated, more savvy political candidate in 2020. And if the UK manages to avoid this particular referendum, you know, this sentiment isn't going away. And if it's not the UK, it'll be another country that has an exit referendum. So in both cases, the book, both for Europe and for the United States, the book Splinterlands was intended as a warning. You know, unless we here in the United States and in the EU change substantially the way our economies and politics function, unless we reach out to these communities that that feel as if they have not benefited at all and by economic and political changes, then we will inevitably experience that same kind of remarkable step backward as these earlier periods.
You used a phrase a moment ago. You said something about hitting a wall. And do you remember using that phrase a moment ago?
Yes.
And what is the wall that if what is the wall that was an analogy or metaphor for?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
what's the physical and political wall?
Uh-huh. Well, the wall basically are people. I mean, if we go back to our discussion of empire, you know, empires collapse because ultimately of people. I mean, it's either because, you know, people on the periphery or in the center say enough and they resist and they say this empire is not benefiting us, it's only benefiting a minority, or it's only benefiting the center and it's not benefiting the periphery. Or in the case I had mentioned of the Mayans, there are simply too many people for the soil to support. So people, again, are the wall against which you run up against. And I would say that, you know, here in the United States, what I would call the backlash community, the community that hasn't benefited from globalization, that their opinion, their political participation was activated in 2016 in ways that nobody anticipated. No one saw the wall because those people fundamentally did not show up in public opinion polls. They either did not participate or they didn't say what their true feelings were, or there just were vast numbers of people who didn't participate politically in the past, and they became politically active. And in so doing, they became the wall against which the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, but more generally, a kind of approach to a political economy collided with.
So here's where it, for me, gets very muddy, because the goals of empire and the concentration of wealth both at the center of empire and in the already powerful is, I think many of us would agree, a bad thing. We don't want wealth to be concentrated at, we don't want the United States to steal from Angola, or to take it 100 years ago, we don't want the British Empire to steal from South Africa. And at the same time, much of this backlash is not only populist in a good sense, but also reactionary in a bad sense. Am I just throwing more mud out here, or does this make any sense?
No, I mean, to give you an example, in order for free trade to work, according to the architects of free trade, they're not speaking from the point of view of wanting to concentrate wealth. In fact, their notion is that you promote free trade to encourage equilibrium. In other words, to bring the poorer countries and the poorer people within those countries up, you know, in their standard of living. That's the free trade argument. But you can find it as well among, you know, developmental economists who might support an entirely different kind of economic arrangement. But they too will say, look, you know, the concentration of wealth in the Northern Hemisphere is simply unsustainable, and folks in the Southern Hemisphere won't accept it, as well as kind of the South within the North, those communities that are impoverished within the Northern Hemisphere. And so we must construct an economy that benefits all. Well, that's all good and fine from either the free trade perspective or the developmental economics perspective. But if you're coming from a nation state perspective and your goal is to lift up the poor within your country, regardless of you know what happens around the world, then you're going to support some economic policies which are not going to be quote unquote progressive, internationally speaking. You know, they will come at the expense of, if especially if you're supporting a kind of a zero-sum economic game. Now you can come at that and say, well, you know, what we need to do is think creatively. Can't think zero-sum. We have to think of ways of raising all the boats by raising the water. We have to think of win-win solutions whereby workers in the United States see benefits as well as workers in China, as well as workers in Bangladesh. That's fine if you and I are having an academic conversation. It's quite another matter in the political realm where candidates are jousting for effect and trying to get votes. And you get votes within a nation state context. You don't get votes in, according to academic arguments or in an international realm. And so I think that's where the waters get muddied. And you get these arguments, for instance, that would help American workers, but because of the way they're expressed in zero-sum terms, they would necessarily deprive, say, those sets of jobs that would stay in the United States from going, say, to Mexico or from going to another country. So I think that's where you have these challenges when you kind of are shifting between both the economic paradigms and you're shifting between the different levels of nation state or international level.
And it, you know, you mentioned that the academic argument that reminded me of the fascinating book, How the Irish Became White.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I took from that is that, you know, when the Irish immigrated when the Irish immigrants arrived in the United States, oftentimes they themselves were very impoverished, and they had a choice. They could have, collectively, they could have working class solidarity with the free blacks in the North, or they could use every advantage they could, including their white skin within the racist society, to feed their children. And
yeah.
When your children are starving to death, you know, forget academic arguments, forget working class solidarity, I need a job.
Yeah.
And so it feels to me like there is just another layer of inevitability with this, with the, you know, when you have suddenly workers in the United States are put for whatever reason into competition with workers in Vietnam, that creates another way of, I don't know how to finish the sentence.
Mm-hmm. No, there's an kind of embedded conflict there. And, you know, part of it, I would say, is just the kind of logic of a nation state. But on top of that, there's, of course, American exceptionalism. And American exceptionalism argues essentially that America is has been blessed by God to prosper within you know, the territorial confines of in, here in North America, and you know, we, because of that, can basically ignore what other countries say. We can ignore international rules and regulations. That our exceptional status throughout history allows us effectively to be greedy, to be, you know, to take as large a slice of the pie as we can grab. And there are, there's exceptionalism light, which would be, say, you know, Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. And then there's exceptionalism, the industrial strength variety, which would be Donald Trump and his America First. So I think that's that additional kind of quality. I mean, most countries have some kind of exceptionalist tradition as part of their national mythos. But the United States is, of course, the largest, most powerful military, has the most powerful military in the world. And so our exceptionalism takes on an entirely different dimension.
So there's two possible directions I want to go, and you can either choose one or the other or both in whatever order you want. And one of them would be to take a step back and to talk about the central conceit, in terms of literary term, of Splinterlands, which is someone looking back from 2050, and then take us through what you, what is your, what is the cautionary tale of Splinterlands? What is the forecast from that perspective? And the other one is just this delightful quote in the middle of Splinterlands, delightful in just because it's really good, but not necessarily happy. I remember reading an article at the time that warned of a Goldilocks apocalypse in which the world wouldn't end with a bang or whimper, but rather with a comfortable sigh of self-satisfaction. This is a wonderful line, by the way. And that, it turned out, was indeed the fate of the United States. Because it refused to engage in a more radical restructuring, it fell victim to the same splintering as the rest of the world. So can you go either one of those directions or both?
Yeah, well, I'll try to go in both directions, beginning with the quote. I mean, the idea of a Goldilocks apocalypse is definitely inspired by the Obama administration. And the Obama administration, like many administrations, came in with a lot of radical ideas and some radical support. Some of it, you know, was immediately put into play with a pledge for disarmament, for instance, or the speech of kind of re-engaging with the Arab world in Cairo. And it seemed in many ways like a Gorbachev perestroika. That here you have this reformer coming from the outside, an unlikely person to make it through the thicket of American politics, and he gets to the top, and he really does want to restructure things in a radical way. But for a variety of reasons, which we won't go into, he's unable to do that. That perhaps because of his disposition, perhaps because of the forces that he confronts in Washington, he instead takes the middle ground. And the middle ground is, you know, ordinarily the safe ground. But in certain circumstances, the middle ground is not the safe ground. Not when you're the edifice of your empire is teetering. The middle ground may prolong for, you know, a year, couple of years, the collapse, but the middle ground is ineffectual in terms of, you know, the kind of reforms that are needed to transform, in this case, the United States, into a sustainable and peaceful country cooperating in the world. So that's what I was thinking in terms of the Goldilocks apocalypse. For the book as a whole, you know, as you said, the main character is looking backwards, and he's looking backwards at from 2050 at the moments when significant cleavage took place in the world. And he's trying to understand, you know, from his background, you know, he had studied the collapse of the Soviet Union, he's trying to understand, well, why did the European Union fall apart? Why did the United States fall apart? Why did China and Russia fall apart? What were the reasons? This is his academic discipline. This is his field of geopaleontology. Understand why these geopolitical dinosaurs died off, essentially. Was it a comet? You know, were they had their brains too small? What are the reasons? And at the same time, because this is a novel, he is also trying to understand why his family has fallen apart. His family is basically scattered to the winds, and they are estranged from him, his three children, his ex-wife. And so he embarks on this kind of double mission to understand why the world fell apart, to understand why his family fell apart. And what is hinted at, but I don't really talk about it to any great extent, is the fate of the United States. I mean, I simply talk about the fact that the United States exists in name alone, but that basically Northern California and Vermont, New Hampshire, and different parts of the country have broken off and have become kind of autonomous regions. And, you know, for me, this has been, and again, this goes back to the Goldilocks apocalypse, this has been something inherent in the structure of the United States from the very beginning, that the federal concept, the notion of these states kind of ceding authority to a federal center, was deeply unpopular at the very beginning of the U.S., of American history, because, of course, the states didn't want to replace the King of England with some substitute in you know, New York, Philadelphia, or Washington. And so they were reluctant to create anything but a confederation. And, of course, we governed under the Articles of Confederation. And for 7 years, it seemed like that was what was going to happen until the founding fathers called for a constitutional convention. And their point was to actually improve the Articles of Confederation, not to come up with a new constitution. But they did a kind of bait and switch. And lo and behold, we get a new constitution that dispenses of confederation altogether and instead creates a federal government, a federal structure. And so this tension between states and the federal center has been there since the beginning. Of course, it achieved its kind of worst moment during the Civil War in the middle of the 19th century. But even after that, it did not disappear. We continued to see the fight, the constant fight, expressed in different ways, whether it was the civil rights movement or on economic issues. And effectively, without a deep transformation of the United States and a kind of reordering of priorities and of the relationship between the states and the federal center, I'm arguing that this is kind of an inevitable path that the United States will go down, that it's not just a question of its global military footprint, which might become or is quickly becoming unsustainable for a variety of reasons, but it's even the territorial integrity of the United States itself. And in both cases, something much more considerable than in terms of transformation is needed than the kind of path of least resistance, the middle path that Barack Obama went down.
So I'm going to read back one line to you again. You've mentioned transformation a couple times. This is a line from the Goldilocks paragraph. Because it refused to engage in a more radical restructuring, it fell victim to the same splintering as the rest of the world. And what would this more radical restructuring look like?
Well, you know, right now we talk about enormous economic, political, and cultural divide in this country. And some of it can be expressed in kind of states versus federal authority. Certainly that was the case during the Obama administration when there was considerable resistance in many states to, you know, Obamacare, to Obama's positions on women's rights, and a whole raft of regulatory issues. But it's not just that. I mean, if you look at kind of where the support for Donald Trump came from, you can identify a kind of, you know, what I would call America B, a part of America that simply has not benefited, as I said earlier, from globalization. So any kind of transformation, I think, has to, first of all, address the profound economic inequality in this country and come up with programs that directly attack that. And it's not just a question of redistribution. It's not just a question of coming up with fair taxation, although that's part of it. I think it also has to be on the production side. I think there has to be a kind of a U.S. government commitment to the kind of jobs program that would lift up these disadvantaged part of the country, whether it's, you know, improving our infrastructure or, you know, building, improving our sustainable energy sector, however it's defined. So that's number one in terms of transformation. Number two, I think, you know, there does have to be a leader who is able to articulate the role the United States plays in the world. Because at the moment, we kind of have these two sterile options, one, the America First of Donald Trump, and the other, a kind of American exceptionalism combined with liberal internationalism, which basically says the United States will kind of participate in these liberal economic and global developments as long as it advantages us, and if it doesn't, we won't participate. But we need a third category. We really do need a leader who can say, and not just a leader, of course, but an entire political movement that articulates a different role for the United States, that understands that cooperation internationally benefits the United States in very concrete ways, and that when we help others, we help ourselves. Absent that kind of a new role for the United States, which of course would require reductions in military spending, it would require us to kind of play well with others on a wide variety of international treaties like the Law of the Seas. Absent that kind of relationship, I think it will be difficult to do that first part, to have an effective economic program, because I do think the two are related.
The radical restructuring of the economy reminds me of two moments in my politicization. I was a fundamentalist Christian when I was a child, raised Seventh-day Adventist, and, you know, nuke the commies and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I started to get out of that during the Vietnam War. I was 11, 12, 13. And one of the things that got me out of it was reading this very short, basically a pamphlet called The Trillion-Dollar Rat Hole. And it was simply a list of the things that could have been done in the United States with the money that had gone to the military post-World War II. Mm. And it was stunning to me. This is like 1972, 1973. And it was things like every city of or every town of more than 5,000 people could have its own hospital. Mm. Every student in the United States could attend college free. I mean, just the bounty was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we see that today as you know, lunch meals or meals on wheels is cut as the military gets more money. And then the second thing I want to bring up is something I learned when I was doing research in the 90s on the B-1 bomber. Mm-hmm. And there was a conversation between George McGovern and one of the manufacturers of the B-1 bomber. And George McGovern said to the manufacturer, you know, if we could get you the money to build school buses, would you build them instead of bombers? And the guy said, of course, we would be happy. We don't care. We just want the money from the government contract.
Mm.
And then they just both burst into laughing because they both knew that they could never get appropriations for school buses through Congress the way they get them for B-1 bombers.
Right.
And so that's a long way of asking, how do we do that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for many years here in Washington.
Because it makes so much sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, here in Washington, we would talk about, the importance of shifting resources from military budget to non-military budget. But we would always kind of put an asterisk to that and say, well, because of the appropriations process, you can't just kind of take money out of the military and apply it directly to the non-military. And then along comes Donald Trump, and in his first budget, that's what he does, except in reverse. He says, we're going to add $54 billion to the military budget, and where is it going to come from? Well, honestly, we're going to be probably cutting taxes, so it's not going to come from that. And there are going to be some other big-ticket items we'll be dealing with, like a wall between the United States and Mexico. So, honestly, folks, we're just going to take it from the domestic side. I mean, literally just going to rob Peter to pay Paul. And that was astonishing to me. I was like, well, I guess he can do it. If he can do it that way, well, we can do it the other way. And I think that, as much as I am horrified by Donald Trump and what he represents, he does suggest to us in a lot of different ways the power that we have been reluctant to tap into, both power of people who are pissed off at the status quo, but also the power, the levers that are available even here in Washington if you are bold enough to claim them.
That's really good. Thank you. So we have like 2 or 3 minutes left, and I'm wondering if there are some things that you want to say about this geopaleontology and this observation of the end of empire that I haven't given you an opportunity to.
Mm. I guess I would say that the discipline of geopaleontology, which I of course made up, doesn't exist, was a way for my main character to kind of examine something dispassionately, that there's a distance between him and what he was studying. And ultimately, in terms of the novel, this is his blind spot. This is his inability to kind of recognize how he is directly involved in what he is, what he's studying in the world around him. This is why his family falls apart, because he doesn't really understand the kind of consequences of his own action. And I think for us, we often here in the United States, I think we go about our lives. I go about my life. I don't think I live in an empire and it has malign consequences. We have to end it tomorrow. I mean, of course, I work, over the long term to kind of deconstruct American empire. But there is still sometimes a certain abstract distance. And it's this abstract distance, which I think, frankly, has reduced the political popularity of our anti-imperial position. That even, Hillary Clinton was by no means anti-imperial, but when she was putting forward a foreign policy that was broadly internationalist, it was too abstract. She was too abstracted from what she was talking about. So from here on in, I think for us to make our case more effectively, we have to be deeply involved in the consequences of empire and telling the stories of people, not only in other countries, but here in the United States, who are not benefiting from this arrangement. And these stories have to be personal, they have to be authentic, they have to be specific, and they have to reach out to the heart, not just the head. If we can do that, and to a certain extent, I would say Donald Trump succeeded in doing that, although, many of his stories were fallacious and much of what he reached out to were the hormones and not the heart. But he did make a direct connection to people. That's something we have to do. We have to be able to make those connections, make those appeals, and we have to kind of, as much as possible, get away from the more abstract understanding of America's role in the world and the impact that America has on its most marginalized.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been John Pfeffer. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.